If you would like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Video recording at the Crossroads by Tom Scott from BBC Engineering Training Centre at Wood Norton in Broadcast Systems Engineering. You can go in any of four directions at this crossroads. Go back to where you came from, that is to continue with the old technology. Go straight on and into digital components and high-definition television. Make a detour right into digital composite, or turn deftly left into analogue components. But is it that simple? In 4 years' time, we will all know the textbook answers. But what do we buy if we need it now? What classifies a videotape recorder as broadcast standard largely depends on custom and practice. Broadly speaking, C-format and high-band U-matic established the presently accepted window some 4 years ago. I suggest that any new analogue recorder, when fully stretched to the intended limit of its generations, should play back at a standard no lower than third generation BVU SP. In the case of a digital machine at full stretch, something better than first generation BVU SP seems more appropriate. Going component means cleaner pictures and extends multi-generation capacity. Splitting into component means splitting the luminance and the chrominance components and handling them separately. The digital component standard, D1, is currently only available from Sony and is the undisputed top-of-the-range videotape recorder. Nestling in between BVU and C-format in terms of price and quality are two rival analog component systems. Sony, Ampex, BTS and Thompson champion the Betacam SP format, with Panasonic and JVC going it alone at present with M2. There are also good reasons for going digital composite. Cost and performance trade-offs have to be made, and new innovations are a worthwhile investment only if they make a significant impact on the perceived standard of programmes. At present, the best place to go digital is at the output of the camera sensors. At least this is the argument of the component or bust supporters. But no, you can't have a YUV splitter block. However, the investment in composite equipment is so large and budgets are too tight for anyone to suggest that digital composite is a U-turn in television. It is a sensible interim measure, which will actually hasten the new dawn by highlighting the value of digital techniques at an acceptable cost. Meanwhile, there's still a little life in C-format and BVU, 3 to 5 years at a guess before they are discontinued. Creep-up formats, such as SVHS, continue to appear, and the universal format is sought as eagerly as ever. Neutrality prevents me from advising you on what to buy, but let's look at the range, bearing in mind that what we want is good video, good audio, and accurate editing. Similarities between Betacam SP and M2. The analog component signals are recorded on two separate tracks, luminance on a Y track, and two colour difference signals compressed and time division multiplexed onto a C track. Vari-speed play is possible from -1 to +2 times normal. Metal particle tape is used, which has many characteristics superior to ferrous oxide types. Carrier-to-noise ratio is better and shorter wavelengths can be recorded. We can work higher up the band with less interference from aliases folded through zero frequency, but not so high as to make the overall deviation too small. Then we'd lose out on signal-to-noise and other considerations because there's always a limit to the highest practicable frequency which can be recovered from tape. Both M2 and SP have four audio channels, That's to say, two analogue longitudinal tracks with selectable Dolby C and two FM channels recorded with the video. It's not a good idea to split stereo sync signals between longitudinal and FM tracks, since anything laid down by a rotating head will be sensitive to control track phase tolerances, which can destroy the sound image. Separate editing of FM audio and video also becomes an impossibility. Both have a designated PCM track area across the position otherwise occupied by the inner longitudinal track of A1. PCM is intended to be laid down as two bursts of audio in a continuation of the Y and C tracks, but with suitable guard gaps to enable editing. M2 can edit interface with Sony equipment. Both formats have edit menus, which include audio splits and can edit to CTL or timecode. Longitudinal and vertical interval timecodes are provided to enable reading at any legitimate play speed, including freeze and also when spooling. Studio machines have integral time-based correction, but some field crews will be looking for a lightweight TBC so that a story can be sent from location to base by the most convenient means, be it cable, inject point, or RF link, with or without sound in syncs.
Thank you.
differences between standard Betacam, Betacam SP, and M2. To enable compatibility with standard Betacam, Sony make use of the upward frequency shift technique tried out on BVU SP. Deviation remains the same, so that an upward shift of the recorded frequencies manifests itself as a DC level shift on demodulation. This property can be used to detect which of the two Betacam variants is in replay, and cross-edits can be detected by examining blanking demodulation level every field. SP luminance carrier frequency is shifted upwards by 2.4 MHz, and the chroma carriers are shifted by 1.6 MHz, with the result that they are virtually identical to those of M2. SP preemphasis is slightly different, but this will probably only affect downward compatibility, preemphasis being one of those things in particular which affects bearding. Initially, compressed time division multiplexing, CTDM, in the Sony was carried out with charge-coupled delays, but it has always been the intention to use digital techniques. The colour difference bandwidth will then be some 2.5 MHz, the same as M2, in which chrominance time compression multiplexing, CTCM, has always been done digitally. Bald YC separation, no comb filter used, does not uniquely separate luminance from chrominance. Provided that any subsequent edits are colour framed, the reconstituted composite video on TBC playback will have the LF-HF luminance phase relationship restored. So long as we re-encode with the original subcarrier, no PAL footprint defects will be visible, but the unnecessary codec process will have lost resolution and almost certainly caused YC delay errors. Both Betacam SP and M2 make use of line 12 to carry composite PAL edit information. SP uses a colour frame flag, whereas M2 inserts an analogue 4.43 MHz subcarrier, which is phase related to the original input video. One of the main sources of picture degradation with multiple generations is that of uncorrected velocity errors. SP detects off-tape jitter by looking at syncs, whereas M2 uses timing bursts, not off subcarrier, to enable zero crossing jitter detection just before the red and blue colour difference signals. SP Betacam cassettes come in two different sizes, which run for 30 and 90 minutes respectively, with only the studio machines accepting both sizes. M2 drew its inspiration from VHS rather than Betamax, and its portable recorders, the AU400 camcorder and AU500 field recorder, use a 20-minute cassette size. Studio versions accept this tape and also a 90-minute cassette, no larger than that of the standard VHS. Not all SP machines have the DT-AST option. For example, a BVW60 is a Sony player only with TBC for transmission or simple edit play-in, whereas the BVW65 is a player which can freeze or go into vary speed thanks to DT. BVW70s and 75s are record play machines which follow a similar nomenclature. The Panasonic AU650 has confidence playback of video and audio, channel 1 and 2, as standard. Analog components in the composite environment. Given typical budget circumstances, there have to be significant and unmistakable advantages in recabling to a component-only environment. Otherwise, the budget would be gone. We'd have no machines, maybe no program money either. But the ducts would be full, the floor loading would be impressive, and the outside broadcast trucks would be heavy and probably awfully hot. Component areas will need careful planning and execution, so that it is likely that hybrid systems will be with us for a while. So I'll ask the question, what is the subcarrier phase control on a coder for? Is it to set SCH to the preferred spec? Or do we twiddle it to get bars right with respect to whatever reference is being used? The first approach requires a well-thought-out timing system, while the other provides an instant solution but needs local vigilance to avoid edit and or PAL footprint problems in hybrid areas. It follows that the quality of the PAL decoder fitted or bought and the stability of the TBC composite output have a significance not always appreciated by the component or bust brigade. In fact, the whole record, insert, assemble process has to be PAL-friendly in timecode and control track modes. Timecode regenerated internally should be accurate, relock correctly if the reference feed is momentarily disturbed, and not become upset if the brooch sequence is corrupt. BVUSP, SVHS, and general testing. These formats use high to low frequency conversion to restrict system bandwidth to manageable proportions. If a narrowband FM system is running out of bandwidth, the most stringent test would be a black on white pulse, and a kinder one would be a swing from grey to the extremes. The worst transition is from maximum to minimum deviation and back again, with quite a lot of energy in the upper sidebands. If this energy is incompletely recovered, the reproduced pulse becomes squatter and fatter, and the picture can exhibit bearding. With a 5T white-on-black pulse resting on 50% APL, the system with a BVU-SP first-generation recording has sufficient sidebands to reach black from grey, but not black from white. But it's perfectly acceptable because the pictures look okay. With a non-broadcast VCR under test, at the 7th generation on a 5 MHz field sweep rate, the low frequency is severely clipped and contains knot-hole aliasing. At 2 MHz, excessive partial rectification is taking place, while at high frequencies, the gain has gone up alarmingly. The pictures look rough. Continuing with video recording technology by Tom Scott from the BBC Engineering Training Centre. C format. I doubt if volume users will buy many more C format machines. Perhaps a few portables where the VPR5 is unequalled, or perhaps a few animation-capable machines, such as the BVH2500 or VPR3. Maybe the odd case will come up where an edit suite has to be expanded, in which case the VPR6 and BVH3000 are attractive. And if it's the first-time buyer anxious to make sales to any place, any time, starting from now, only C format offers unrivalled market penetration. Sony even make a 1-inch machine, BVH2800 series, which lays down two PCM audio channels in the space normally occupied by Audio 4 or the Sync option. Killing off C format will take at least 3 years, and even after that it will be used in archive retrieval for many years. Besides, it takes time for any new format to penetrate the market, overcome inertia, suffer teething troubles, and dispel rumours, if any. Less than so many units, the critical mass, and production folds. More than the critical mass, and a fast breeder reaction sets in. Ampex may well have prolonged the life of C format with two techniques, one of which deals with uncorrected velocity errors, and the other helps prevent a unidirectional drift of lineup errors in multi-generation. The developments are the Zeus Advanced Digital Processor and MGen. With Zeus, one line of video is held in a high-quality CCD store, and its burst is gated onto the next line as it is received. The right oscillator frequency is then modified to produce clocks with errors corresponding to the jittery input described by the two bursts. Velocity errors are removed at the start of the A to D process, so that the read clocks in the digital domain are rock steady and locked to station reference. Conventional velocity error correction does not have simultaneous access to two bursts, and so it is the read clocks which are jittered. The Zeus output can be a direct digital stream to a D2 VCR. Now, just imagine a Sony BVH2800 coupled to an Ampex Zeus so as to play both digital video and PCM audio into a Hitachi D2 recorder. Also, if you've a VPR3 with the MGen option, the VPR can run up 10 generations buttered together in real time so that the operator can see where lineup errors are accumulating and correct them. Finally, if you're going to buy a conventional C format TBC, then please give your editors a treat by avoiding ones which can only handle normal play speed. VT editors like to rock over their edit points to trim them and check for flashes when it's done. Thumbnail sketch of D1 and D2. The cassette shell, but not the tape material, is common to both formats. Each has four digital audio tracks sampled at 48 kHz using 16 bits, with provision for 20 to match the AES EBU recommendation. 8-bit resolution is used for the video in both cases, and error correction is by Reed-Solomon codes. Both D1 and D2 are segmented formats recorded on 3/4-inch wide tape and have timecode, control and audio cue tracks. The Sony DVR-1000, as an example of digital component D1, is a dual-standard VCR, but not a standards converter, which accepts CCIR-601 component signals and records on an improved metal oxide tape. Two thicknesses of tape are used, 16 micrometers and 13 micrometers in three play lengths of 11, 34 and 76 minutes for the thicker tape and 13, 41 and 94 minutes for the thinner. Only the D1 recorded format is specified, leaving the number of heads, scanner speed and wrap angle to the manufacturer. The Sony DVR-1000 uses 16 head gaps arranged in 6 diametrically opposed pairs. Audio and confidence heads are symmetrically disposed about a common axis, with 2 pairs of combined record erase heads at right angles to this. Each audio pair has one head for edit pre-read and one for playback. Each record-erase combination is a pair of heads bonded in a single structure to compensate for any erasure mistracking. Each 625 50Hz field is made up of six segments of 50 lines, so that 12 tracks must be scanned per field. The video is laid down in non-azimuth tracks with guard bands using a randomised non-return-to-zero code. The four channels of digital audio have data shuffled, interleaved and recorded twice in data bursts at the centre of the video tracks, with gaps to help with editing. Centre of track recording was chosen to minimise edge damage and tape stretch effects, and have good head-to-tape contact. Unfortunately, the penalty is a slow-mo range of minus a quarter to plus a quarter times normal speed and still field frame with pictures in shuttle up to plus 40. This is because track jumps are possible only at the audio blocks, sound is generally discarded in slow motion, and it also means that tape speed override, TSO, is impossible since all the audio has to be recovered for broadcast. Therefore, track jumps cannot be made.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter to me. To me.
Mama just killed a man.
Spare him his life from this monstrosity.
Easy easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah, no, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go!
We'll not let you go.
Let me go!
Mamma mia, mamma mia!
Mamma mia, let me go! Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me, for me, for me!
The D2 digital composite format. The inspiration for D2 came from the ACR225 spot player developed by Ampex. The VPR300 is a 625 line 50Hz PAL VCR, which is a plug-for-plug replacement for C format. The VPR300 has all the features expected in a top-notch VTR and is one of three D2 VCRs available. The others coming from Sony and Hitachi. They all offer play lengths of 32, 94 and 208 minutes. D2 uses high coercivity metal tape, similar to RDAT, whereas D1 effectively has two 13.5 MHz sampled streams, Y, CR and CB. D2 samples at 4 times subcarrier frequency. So, two pairs of heads scanning 8 tracks per field is enough. Azimuth recording is used together with Miller squared channel code, chosen for its low DC content and relative lack of LF fringing effects. There is no need for erase heads, and deliberate overwriting can be used to have a self-sharpening effect. In playing across any 3 tracks, only the center one can have the correct azimuth. Azimuth recording also means that tracking errors are not troublesome, and since there is more certainty of acquiring and following the correct tracks, the audio bursts can now be laid down in pairs at the beginning and end of each track. Track jumping is now possible with the customary range of -1 to +3 times normal speed, as well as tape speed override to ±15%. Audio must be fully recovered in TSO, which precludes track jumps, so as the transport speed is altered, drum and capstan change in proportion, leaving the sound supervisor to change audio pitch and the viewer to put up with occasional fields being missed or repeated. To deal with the PAL 8-field sequence, the best thing to do is to sample in phase with the burst and use a PAL modifier to invert the U and V polarities where necessary following an intrinsic 4-line sequence. It also helps to record each field beginning with the same chroma phase. Extra lines will have to be recorded, but illegitimate ones can be discarded so that a standard PAL 8 field sequence is maintained in play and stunt modes. Shuttle is another beneficiary, with colour pictures possible up to 60 times normal speed. And the future of recording. No one wants to give up facilities unless it's absolutely necessary, so that the absence of the customary full range of stunt mode speeds and the problems with TSO are drawbacks in D1. Undoubtedly, the format is capable of more development, but at present, any such effects wanted at the post-production stage will have to be done in a sidechain using a solid-state recorder. In a few years, there will probably be another new format called D3 that will combine the best features of D1 and D2. Naturally, it will be component, and there may even be a solid-state telecine to partner it. But until that day, D1 will be the flagship, just as the Rank Syntel DigiScan 422 is in its own field. D2 will sell, because it is just what the broadcaster running on tighter and tighter budgets needs. It is doubtful that it will sell to the extent that C format did, because D3 will come and the analog component recorders will eat into territory once the undisputed province of 1 inch. BVU will be the first of the old timers to go. Already Betacam has displaced some units, and with the arrival of M2 and Betacam SP, it's just a case of getting your money's worth, then changing over. The component analog recorders are pretty evenly matched, and I expect that the Betacam SP will eventually cease to be badge engineered. I wonder if Ampex will graft some of its Zeus wizardry onto it. Meanwhile, M2 has its fanciers, and should establish its critical mass, and no doubt will receive its share of refining as time goes by. Even so, you can't rule out the possibility of some accommodation between manufacturers to produce a common model. That's how C format came about. C format probably has a production run of 3 to 5 years left, depending how D2 gets on. The Sony BVH 2800 and Ampex Zeus are useful hybrids in transferring stuff to D2 and even D1, as well as extending the generations. Hybrid Cs are an area which ought to develop, so look out for an Ampex with PCM and a Sony with a funny TBC. SVHS will be pushed for use in hostile environments, and just when you think all the possible formats have been exhausted, someone will come out with this optical thingy with lasers and all the whistles and bells you could possibly want.
When you need to know. but they're all I have never paid. There's a river flowing by a willow tree. When you find
Radio Fax 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brook.
And Holly Robson.
A few weeks ago, we read out Douglas Self's article from Electronics and Wireless World about subjectivism in audio. The letters pages have been raging. With firstly, this contribution to the editor.
Pseudo audio. I read with interest Mr. Self's article in July on the contemporary attitude to audio engineering and its products, and I'm grateful that the EWW has provided a forum in which this matter can be debated. Since Mr. Self invites comments, I would like to offer a few thoughts on this topic. Firstly, I'm wholeheartedly in favour of his basic premise that engineering progress must be founded on objective and reproducible measurements and on specific technical goals. Opinions, however, August, their author, cannot be anything other than a possible corroboration that the technical targets sought by the engineers are correct, or an indication that the desired specification is in some way less than adequate. However, the fact that the subjective sound pundits ever got their foot in the door of the standards laboratory in the first place is the engineer's own fault. In that when transistor amplifiers were first introduced, as an improvement on the existing valve-operated designs, they suffered from large amounts of residual crossover distortion, less than 0.1% perhaps at full output power, but several percent at normal listening levels. The engineers and the manufacturer's sales blurbs say they were excellent, but the man in the street and his wife thought they were nasty to listen to, as indeed they were. We, as engineers, having tardily admitted our error in this matter, then went on to stabilise our amplifier designs, which had massive amounts of negative feedback, to improve the steady-state linearity with dominant lag compensation, usually cross the second gain stage within the overall feedback loop, because this particular technique led to the best high-frequency THD figure. This led, in turn, to audibly objectionable slew rate limiting effects, the existence of which was again overlooked in the specification, but made the amplifier sound poor, especially at higher output levels. Once again, the man in the street noted that there were differences in sound quality between similarly specified designs, and that what we said was superb might not provide the sound quality he expected. This and a few dozen other similar oversights gave the potential buyer of audio equipment the incentive to seek opinions based on listening trials conducted by respected figures among the golden-eared fraternity, and provided a ready market for the publishers of the magazines which catered for this area of public disquiet. While I arrived on the transistor audio amplifier design scene rather too late to fall into the pitfall of Class B crossover distortion, and I was aware enough to offer designs which were not slew rate limited, I'm sure there were other things which I did not do as well as I should, simply because I do not know sufficiently fully the performance standards which I should seek to meet, or the tests which I need to apply to disclose the faults which a careful listener with good program material and ideal listening conditions might perceive. Taking one specific point arising from Mr. Self's article, I think he, like the audio engineering world in general, places too much reliance on the steady-state tests, such as his low signal level THD measurements on different types of capacitors, which appear to have convinced him that there are no effective performance differences between different capacitor types. This may indeed be perfectly true under steady-state conditions. It is my opinion that the pursuit of steady-state linearity has now been carried to such lengths that the bulk of the residual differences between specified electrical performance and apparent sound quality lie in the normally inadequately specified behaviour of the audio system under discontinuous or transient signals which make up a large proportion of music or speech. It is in this respect that many components, particularly capacitors, exhibit a range of known and measurable defects. With regard to the transient performance of audio equipment in general, it's certainly possible to distinguish between systems having adequately low steady-state waveform distortion, but with large differences in their response to step changes or other waveform discontinuities. However, since these differences in transient response are seldom measured, and the performance in this respect is seldom defined, it's possible that in the eyes of the lay user, the differing units will appear to be identically specified, which leads to a consequent but disappointed expectation of identical sound quality. I would point, in this context, to the substantial improvements which have been made in sound quality during the development of both cassette recorders and compact disc players, as between early and later designs of the same systems, of which much of the improved performance is due to significant improvements in the accuracy of reproduction of transient-type signals, rather than to any lessening of harmonic distortion. Overall, I simply do not believe that we yet know enough about the importance, in audio terms, of some of the electrical shortcomings of components, or of the waveform distortions arising in the signal chain due to component imperfections or injudicious circuit design, which lead to effects which can be both demonstrated and measured, for us as engineers to be able to say that there will be no audible difference between component A having one set of known defects and component B which has another different set, or between systems of which only some of the characteristics are identical. This is not intended as a justification for high tensile steel control knobs or mains wiring made from single crystal copper, but as a plea that we should try to assess the significance of the electrical phenomena we do know about and can measure, before saying that defects due to this cause don't exist, or that the effects that they do introduce must be inaudible, in view of the fact that most available program material is already degraded. That letter comes from Mr. J. L. Lindsley Hood from West Monkton in Somerset.
And after John Lindsley Hood's contribution, to this debate, then Reg Williamson. Could it be that my stiff neck is due to the vigorous nodding of my head whilst reading Doug Self's article? Alas, I fear that in your august journal, his well-reasoned arguments are largely directed at the converted. It is safe to assume that, had he offered it to the editorial office of any of the well-known hi-fi comics, it would have met with the enthusiasm accorded to a dead rodent. I cannot but agree with every word, and I say this with feeling, having contributed regularly to the emerging hi-fi magazine world in the distant past, reviewing as well. But what I find much more disturbing is the steady erosion of ethical standards, which the review industry, I use the word advisedly, the deterioration of technical competence, and what appears to be covert corruption as well. Strong stuff. Yes, it is, but there is more than enough evidence of its truth. On the question of standards, for a start, amongst those reviewers who actively lobby manufacturers and import agents for work, very few have any academic qualifications or training whatsoever. I usually refer to them as the ex-shop assistant brigade. From them, we cannot really expect anything other than their own concept of what is acceptable. Sadly, that tiny minority who do have an engineering background have now been fully corrupted by what I refer to as the Emperor's Clothes Syndrome. They either join the subjectivist chorus or lose work. Simple as that. It isn't helped either by university academics who lend a gloss of respectability by contributing largely unreadable treatises from their ivory towers. We must remember, and this must not be interpreted as a justification for all this nonsense, that hi-fi is now about consumer durables, like washing powder. Change the perfume, and this is the new improved hi-fi amplifier. And a sycophantic review press obligingly dances to the industry's tune. Ethics? Who pays for those trips to shows abroad? Not the magazine, that's for sure. Why are some advertisements refused by at least one well-known magazine with no explanation given? Why does at least one of our leading high-quality audio manufacturers, Quad, openly discourage reviews of their products? Could it be that, bearing in mind the questionable expertise of those to whom their product is entrusted, they regard a good review just as damaging as a bad one? Looking at a couple recently, a very expensive amplifier was measured as having an overload of 23 dB on a CD input of 100 mV sensitivity. Another, in which a CD player measured poorly, yet sounded the, quote, best. In both cases, the reviewers had some degree of engineering qualification, yet not one word of explanation. These two examples are far from isolated. Readers of this magazine will need no explanation from me as to the absolute failure in this instance to justify public trust. Like Doug Self, I fear this nonsense is going to be with us a while yet. Experienced engineers will run a mile rather than take on a review commission these days. This is not to say its end could not be hastened. Reputable manufacturers could go public and disown all reviews until the magazine business puts its house in order. Those reviewers who do still enjoy some respect and are clinging to the wreckage, a mere handful, sad to say, should cease their ambivalence. Abandon all that euphemistic custard poured over a dubious product. Emulate the little girl in the fairy tale and cry, "But this is rubbish." I'd like to think it was possible, but you know they have an earning, a living to earn. Meanwhile, I shall go on doing my best at the university where I teach and nip this rubbish in the bud as soon as I see it. Reg Williamson, Kidsgrove in Staffordshire.
You
More letters on the subject of subjectivism in audio from John Howarth in Hull, Humberside. Three cheers for Doug Self and his spirited attack on the lunatic fringe of the hi-fi fraternity. More power to his elbow. I would like him to know that there are plenty of us out here who are strictly amateurs as far as audio engineering and hi-fi are concerned, but who are nonetheless enthusiasts and who have some sort of rigorous scientific training, who find it impossible to swallow some of the nonsense currently propounded. I, for one, believe the following. Amongst other things, the list is purely representative, but one could go on and on. 1. Any subjective audible difference between, say, amplifiers, which can be shown to exist by means of statistically well-controlled double-blind trial, can be explained in terms of measurement and current scientific knowledge. 2. It is possible to make one's own perfectly competent, if modestly powered, amplifier, whose performance need not sensibly be improved any further for less than £150. 3. Loudspeaker cables have a small resistance, even smaller reactance, and that is the end of it. Discussions of skin depth, or worse, transmission lines, are ludicrous at audio frequencies. And 4. Differences between electromechanical transducers and recording techniques, microphone placement, etc., far outweigh anything else in subjective terms. All this seems really very obvious, and yet such is the current seizure of the high ground by the subjective extremists that I, an amateur at that, feel obliged to state it. Can I put in a plea for people to stand up and say so if they honestly can't tell the difference between amplifier A or B, and not be intimidated into thinking that they have got cloth ears rather than golden ones. Let us have the courage to shout, "The king isn't wearing any clothes." John Howarth, Hull, Humberside.
Dear Sir, it was with some interest and relief that I read the article by DRG Self. As a professional engineer with an interest in high-quality sound reproduction, I have always thought of subjectivism as having little technical foundation and having less common sense. I would not, however, have been moved to put pen to paper if it were not for an article published in the June 1988 edition of Hi-Fi Answers. The item, entitled Free of Charge, in my view transcends by orders of magnitude any other writings on subjective audio. In it, the author, Mr. J. Hughes, puts forward the theories of Mr. P. Belt, claiming that the sound of your hi-fi is affected by such perverse things as the number of CDs on your shelf, your wristwatch, and even whether your sofa has three or four legs, etc. Much more worrying is the theory that all unused mains power appliances in the home must be neutralised by shortening the live and neutral pins of the mains plug with a piece of wire and crocodile clips. Although the author does state that appliances must be unplugged for safety, the implications for safety in the home are clearly worrying if the readers believe the rest of the article. After telephoning the editorial department of Hi-Fi Answers to check if the article was genuine, which it was, I have written to both the magazine and the publishing company to complain. If, as Mr. Belt claims, all items in the listening room that carry a static electromagnetic charge should be neutralised, perhaps the listener should retire to another part of the house whenever the hi-fi is operating, as he or she could be carrying a large static charge and is definitely a source of electromagnetic interference. In conclusion, subjectivism into the area of hi-fi has now moved way beyond the realm of good sense, and one wonders where it can possibly go from here. That letter was from S.J. Shorey from Dartford in Kent.
And the final riposte from Douglas Self. Dear Sir, I found Mr. Nolte's letter in the August issue a disappointment. though admittedly not an unexpected one. In my letter, in the June issue, I directly challenged him to be more specific in his speculations about insidious audio impairment, so that they could be tested for existence. Regrettably, he appears to be unable to do so. I therefore remain unconvinced that dielectric absorption has any relevance to a competently designed audio circuit. If I may repeat myself, can any subjectivist provide a hypothesis as to how an audio signal can be modified by this effect? It is, I think, not unreasonable to ask for a diagram of how the waveform is modified, so I shall know what to look for. As for why Mr. Nolte's customers profess themselves happy with his £10 resistors, I suggest the answer lies in psychology rather than technology. Few people are prepared to admit to themselves that they have been made fools of, if there is any way of avoiding the issue. Psychologists call this avoidance of cognitive dissonance. And while the jargon may be recent, the result is as old as humanity. I regret that I find Mr. Nolte's list of references unconvincing. Repetition does not constitute verification. And the fact that he has been saying the same thing for some time does not make it true. For example, reference 4 confuses series with shunt feedback, and reference 7 contains the statement, quote, "harmonic distortion measurements have no direct relevance at all to sound quality," from which I can only assume that he has never used a telephone. Similarly, for Mr. Nolte to claim that his ears are, quote, "the best instrumentation of all," strikes me as downright silly, as I contemplate my audio precision, which effortlessly resolves down to 0.0005% under computer control. I should be happy to try the same measurements with Mr. Nolte's ears, if he is prepared to submit to the surgical procedures involved. Mr. Nolte then administers the coup de grâce to rationality by insisting that scientific measurements are only valid provided they reinforce the judgments made by our own ears. Or, alternatively, only valid if they fit pet theories and hidebound preconceptions. To summarise, the basic problems for subjectives remain much as they have done. There is a chronic lack of hypotheses suitable for experimental testing. By now, any impartial observer must have concluded that this is because to put forward a mechanism is simply to invite embarrassment when it turns out not to exist. There is no help whatsoever from the huge body of knowledge that is psychoacoustics. Experiments on oral perception, carried out all over the world and endlessly replicated and confirmed, show beyond doubt that the human ear functions strictly within the known laws of science. There are too many internal contradictions. For example, esoteric speaker cables that vary wildly in their construction. Just about any configuration that conducts electricity has its devotees. This alone strongly suggests that no real physical effect is involved. Subtraction tests prove beyond cavil that the imperfections of a competent amplifier are inaudible when presented alone. They are clearly doubly inaudible when masked by the main signal. And finally, no help at all from the likes of Peter Belt. Yours faithfully, Douglas Self, Forest Gate, London, East 15.
You're not afraid to feel.
Now to something from Media Network on Radio Netherlands.
Now we cross to Massachusetts, USA, and on the line from Boston is Media Network's Lou Josephs. For last week, the radio ship Sarah, home of Radio New York International, and docked in international waters some 4.5 miles off Atlantic Beach, Long Island, came back on the air. What happened exactly, Lou?
Well, Jonathan, Peter Scivoletti in Burlington noticed a tone and alerted us to the fact that there was open carrier on 1620, Saturday UTC time at about midnight 50. Then at 0100 UTC, a full ID was given and an hour's worth of uninterrupted music began as Radio New York International, operating from the motor vessel Sarah, returned to the air.
Well, here we are at RNI, Radio Sarah, 1620 AM, and we'll be with you till midnight, maybe even a little bit more.
Now, back in July last year, they flew a Honduran flag and yet were boarded by U.S. Coast Guard and Federal Communication Commission officials within days of going on the air. What flag were they flying this time?
Jonathan, most pirates try to fly a flag of convenience. Could be the Honduras or perhaps Panama. In the case of the Sarah, this time they're flying the flag of the Principality of Sealand.
And you may recall that Sealand is a wartime concrete fort now lying within British territorial waters. British owner Roy Bates maintains that the artificial island is in fact a separate country, though he's had problems obtaining international recognition for that claim. Sealand has postage stamps and even a flag. The one fluttering from the radio ship Sarah at the moment is a curious legal development. We've been snowed under with telephone calls from listeners in eastern North America who've heard the station. So what's been your experience in Boston, Lou?
The observed schedule so far, Jonathan, of Radio New York International appears to be from 0100 UTC to just past 0400. Some sign-offs have been as late as 0430. The only frequency in use appears to be 1620 medium wave, although we know the Sarah has the capability of FM and high-frequency shortwave.
Well, we're using the present tense at the moment, but on Monday, the Federal Communications Commission did start making moves to silence RNI. They got U.S. District Judge John J. McNaught in Boston to issue a temporary restraining order forbidding the ship from broadcasting. At 10 p.m. local time on Monday, U.S. officials on board a Coast Guard vessel pulled alongside the good ship Sarah and tried to serve those on board with a legal notice. The crew refused to allow the officials on board, so the order was then read over a loud hailer system. Those on deck of the Sarah shouted back, asking the U.S. officials to repeat certain passages. The on-air disc jockey then signed off, saying that Radio New York International had technical difficulties. Lawyers representing the project manager, Alan Wiener, says that he doesn't own the Sarah anymore. He registered the old coaster as a pleasure boat in Maine and then sold it to a British concern 2 weeks ago, with an option to buy it back. Right, Lou, the ship is still out at sea. What do you expect the FCC to do if the Sarah breaks that restraining order?
I suspect the federal government is going to throw the book at them. Open the door and throw away the key.
Well, thanks to the many listeners who helped us compile that information.
That was Jonathan Marks from Media Network.
Are you interested in improving AM reception? We are now producing a PhaseLock AM synchronous detector unit. There are four controls on the front panel. Loop, wide, medium or narrow, allows use with unstable signals or transmitters carrying phase-modulated radio data. Next, a selector provides low distortion envelope detection, double sideband, lower sideband, upper sideband, independent sideband or stereo spread, giving intriguing effects with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, and quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and allows audio from any weaker co-channel station to be heard more clearly. The remaining two controls are center frequency and window on-off, which enables the unit to hold lock tenaciously, even under severe interference or complete fade-out. Apart from the well-known benefit of reducing the gross distortion of selective fading, synchronous detection also provides an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. The remaining objectionable effect during a selective fade is the surging in audio level, as the receiver AGC unnecessarily increases the gain. So our unit also includes a broadcast quality multiple time constant audio limiter. The complete boxed unit costs £150, and a detailed information sheet is available if you send along 1 14-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. This is Radio Fax, broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
Now to two articles from the Financial Times, both written by Raymond Snoddy. STV bucks the trend as profits fall to £2.5 million. Scottish Television has announced a drop in pre-tax profits, a result against the trend in the generally buoyant commercial television sector. In the half year to June, the independent television contractor for Central Scotland made pre-tax profits of £2.5 million, compared with £2.64 million previously. Turnover increased from £36.68 million to £39.76 million. The 5% fall compares with a 21% increase in pre-tax profits announced on Thursday by HTV, the ITV contractor for Wales and the West of England. The company's shares fell 7p to close at 3.59. Sir Campbell Fraser, STV chairman, said that in order to cope with the changes now facing the ITV system, the company had taken measures which would be costly in the short term but would pay off in terms of future growth. Exceptional operating costs, for example, of £465,000 went to pay for between 20 and 30 early retirements this year, and further job cuts are expected. The cost of launching late-night television was still not matched by the extra advertising revenue, and the company's overall share of advertising had fallen from 5.6% in the first half of 1987 to 5.3% this time. Mr. Alan Montgomery, finance director, said, "As well as losing advertising share as money flowed into the South, we have incurred new costs." In addition, profits for the full year were expected to be flat, with a better performance likely in 1989. Mr. Andrew Hunter, leisure analyst of stockbrokers McCorkin, Dyson, Capel, Cure, said that he'd found it disappointing that Scottish had taken all its costs at one time. He downgraded STV's expected full-year pre-tax profits to £8.9 million. Scottish had also made it clear that it would write off the full value of its investment of just over £1 million in Super Channel, the general entertainment satellite channel, in the full year results. The write-off would become an extraordinary item. Earnings per share fell from 15.35 pence to 14.28 pence, although the interim dividend will be 3.75 pence compared with 3.5 pence. The company expects the purchase of outplacement consultant Pauline Hyde and Associates, a company specialising in finding jobs for redundant executives, to make a good contribution to future profits, and further acquisitions in the sector are possible. The second item, Ulster rises to £2.2 million. Ulster Television increased pre-tax profits in the year to July from £1.91 million to £2.19 million on turnover, which increased from £20.012 million to £22.214 million. The ITV contractor for Northern Ireland, which has traditionally had difficulty achieving what it saw as its fair share of national advertising, had television operating profit of £1.827 million, investment income of £324,000, and profit from disposal of investments of £34,000. Earnings per basic share rose from 12.11 pence to 13.61 pence. The company is proposing a final dividend of 2.75 pence, making 4.75 pence for the year, compared with 3.7 pence last year.
And comment in the Financial Times Lex column on ITV companies. Broadcasting reform may yet do its bit to harm British culture, but for the moment at least, investors seem to be adopting a more sanguine view about its effect on the profitability of independent television. ITV company shares have risen sharply over the past 2 days, seven of them showing percentage rises in two figures since Monday. Only Scottish TV's poor results helped it buck the trend. There is still plenty around to be worried about, of course, and yesterday's limited trading volumes suggest that most investors are content to stick with their anxieties. But after months frozen in fear of the broadcasting white paper, now due in mid-November, things may have started to move. HTV was the catalyst this week, reporting a fourfold increase in overseas programme sales. And whether it was the stock's downright cheapness, its prospective ratings languishing at around 5x earnings, its 7% yield, or its proven ability to adapt to reform of the Exchequer levy system, HTV's success inspired a stricken sector. The companies started the week on valuations which found room for just about every bit of bad news imaginable. Competition for advertising, the cost of bidding for franchises, even the loss of the franchise altogether. Now, the market seems to be paying some attention to the potential advantages of reform, a lighter public service burden, and the possibility of takeovers, however distant and uncertain. Further reform of the levy system, which has nothing to do with the white paper, could still deal the sector a nasty blow. But with the smaller companies clustered around prospective PEs of 5 or 6 and the less vulnerable larger companies on 8 or so, there could be more to come.
And now to your letters. Italy has obviously been picking us up well because we've had two letters from listeners over there. First one from Marzio Visoni, who comes from Lusa in Italy. I was really surprised to listen to the nice and interesting programmes of Radio Facts here in my little town in Italy. We'd like to thank you, Marzio, for that huge pile of Italian station stickers, which are all around our studio walls.
And also from Roberto Pavanello from Vercelli in Italy. He says, I have very great pleasure in sending you this reception report of your station operating on 1611.
Back to England now, and a letter from Roy Trent, who comes from Pillsworth, Bury in Lancashire. He says, congratulations on your fabulous radio station. I now have a lot of my friends listening to you. Very good reception on 6205, lousy on 1611.
And thank you to John Coxon from Springwell, Gateshead, Tyne and Wear for your letter. And from Glasgow in Scotland, as Clyde Cable provide Radio Nova, I was particularly interested in the item you had on them and Radio Radio. Although I have the cable link, I don't think I've ever seriously listened to the Radio Nova programmes. I also enjoyed your taste in music. That's from Charles Scott from Knightswood in Glasgow, and he's referring to a time before Radio Nova changed its daytime operation to classical format.
Now over the waters to Sweden, and a letter from Magnus Jespersen, who says, thanks for the programme. I'm 30 years old and an engineer, working with computers at C.E. Jonsson Limited, a company that manufactures measuring equipment for process industrial applications. He reports that reception over there is good, so that's thank you to Magnus Jespersen from Sweden.
And from Belgium, I tried several times to listen to what seems to be very interesting programmes, fully dedicated to the world of broadcasting. Thank you, Daniel Aranovich from Brussels in Belgium. And thank you to Krista Sandberg from Karlstad in Sweden for your letter.
Now to an article from The Independent. The BBC goes into the film industry. The BBC is to follow Channel 4 and enter the film industry. It will back 6 films a year, made both by staff and outside producers, to be screened first on BBC, Maggie Brown writes. Those made with BBC resources will have an automatic right of release to cinemas under an agreement soon to be concluded with the unions. The new development, being worked out with the BBC Enterprises, could prove a profitable departure. For an investment of around £500,000 of the $4 to $5 million total cost of making a film, it secures UK television rights and a share of the equity. The plan is spearheaded by Mark Shivers, BBC Television's new head of drama group, who rejoined the corporation 2 months ago after a period as an independent filmmaker. Mr. Shivers, who made the films Moonlighting and A Private Function and the series Glittering Prizes, says the films will be mainstream, suitable to appear on television, no schlock. We've been sent the information for this year's Digital Information Exchange, and this is what their marketing package has to say about it. The Digital Information Exchange is back in London Zoo this November, offering the audio professional a unique perspective of new and emerging digital technology. The organisers are committed to providing a comfortable environment, one where equipment can be demonstrated and in which professionals drawn from the allied fields of broadcast engineering, video production, studio recording and leisure industry marketing can assess it objectively. At the same time, delegates gain a special opportunity to discuss the application of hardware options with experts and those responsible for their design and manufacture. Just a glance at the three-day event confirms that the 1988 Digital Information Exchange has its most powerful program yet. The exchange takes place on November the 22nd, 23rd and 24th at London Zoo. If you would like more information, you can contact Francis Sharp at the Digital Information Exchange, Free Post, London, SW6, 7BR.